On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. War and the Writing of War is a deep marriage in America. The books are familiar and seminal. Hemingway's Farewell to Arms, Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead, Joseph Heller's Catch-22, Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-5, the books of Tim O'Brien. Now a new generation of American soldiers is writing about its war, Iraq. And how they wrote, why they wrote, and what they churned is the subject of a new PBS documentary called Operation Homecoming. Up next, On Point, The Written Word at Wartime. We'll be talking this hour with three U.S. soldiers featured in the new PBS documentary Operation Homecoming, Writing the Wartime Experience, which airs tonight on PBS. Former Army Specialist Colby Bazell, Captain Ed Rivnak, flight nurse in the Air Force Reserve, and Jack Lewis, former Army Reservist, will be our guests. But I want to turn first to Richard Robbins. He's an award-winning documentary filmmaker. He's worked at Frontline, ABC News, and PJ, Peter Jennings Productions. He's the director, producer, and writer of Operation Homecoming, Writing the Wartime Experience, and he joins us now from Los Angeles. Richard, it's so nice to have you with us. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us, what's the genesis of this project? How did it come about?
Well, there are a small group of us who formed a little production company with Peter when he was still alive. And part of the reason we wanted to make a company separate from ABC News was to try and do projects that we felt like couldn't be done in a network news context. And when the war started, one of those subjects that was felt very pressing to us was to try and find a way to present a more human picture of what was going on in Iraq. When the National Endowment for the Arts announced Operation Homecoming, that they were going to start collecting writing from troops and their families, as well as running these writing workshops on military bases around the world, it just seemed like an incredible opportunity to... I had done some work with the troops before, having covered the war in Afghanistan, and I knew how hard it was to get people to speak honestly about their experiences. So one of the things you get when you find troops who write are people who have sort of self-selected as feeling like they want to communicate. They have something they want to say. So the two together just seemed like a great opportunity.
Mm. So how did the National Endowment for the Arts collect these writings?
I couldn't tell you that much about the mechanics of it. They put out the word in, sort of through the chain of command throughout the military community. Their project included families as well. We unfortunately didn't have time to include the writing from families. And the writings just poured in. I think they continue to pour in to the National Endowment for the Arts.
Was there a particular criteria or a content you were looking for? In other words, how did you select the writings that you used in the documentary?
We get asked that a lot. I wish I could say there was some sort of scientific method. We had about 10,000 pages, roughly 1,500 separate pieces of writing, and it took us quite a while to get the funding together to make this film, so I had a good long time to read everything. And there are certain pieces that just stayed with you, that felt so honest and fresh and intimate and unexpected in ways. And I would say that the first cut, getting from 1,500 down to about 100, was pretty straightforward. They're just, certain people who write really beautifully And then it got harder and harder from there. And the last cut, there are probably a dozen pieces that I know very well wanted to use in the film but just didn't have room for. Mm.
The documentary covers a full spectrum of writing, from poetry and fiction to memoirs and letters and journals and essays. Some of the stories are sad and others are funny. Some are violent. Others are uplifting. And as I was watching this, Richard, I thought to myself that there was such honesty and intensity involved in each of these writings, and it felt in many ways as though the soldiers, their writing was a lifeline for them in some ways. Is that right?
I think that's true, and obviously you should ask them, but I think that most of these troops wrote because they were trying to make sense of what was happening to them, and writing for a lot of people is a way to try and give order and clarity and meaning to things that can often seem overwhelming, meaningless. And I also think that there's a kind of intimacy that goes on between, you know, in the written word. You know, when you sit down to write, you're largely by yourself, you and the blank page. And I think that there is a level of intimacy and intensity and honesty that you can find in writing that's very hard to capture in other ways.
Mm. I want to bring in a 28-year-old California native, Colby Bazell, who joins us now from New York. Richard, hold on for just a moment. He was an Army specialist with the 3rd Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division, serving in Iraq from November 2003 to October 2004, stationed in Mosul. His short story, Men in Black, is featured in the documentary Operation Homecoming, to air tonight on PBS. He's the author of the book My War and currently writes for Esquire magazine. Colby Bazell, thank you for being here.
Hello.
What was it like for you listening to your words coming to life in this documentary?
It took me a couple of days to... the first time I saw it, I actually turned it off. I didn't want to... watch it, but then a couple days later I turned it back on and watched it, and it was kind of surreal seeing it depicted and having another person read over it, and it just brought back a lot of memories of that day and stuff, so that was kind of weird.
Why'd you turn it off? Was it hard to watch?
Yeah, because it's one of those days I don't really want to think too much about, and then you see it on TV and it, you know, you just sort of want to tune it out, but you know, I've watched it. I've watched it a couple times, and I thought they did a great job adapting it.
I want to play a clip from the documentary. This is from your story, Men in Black. Set this up for us, if you would, Colby. What's happening in the scene we're about to hear?
It was just a normal day, and then all of a sudden, the mortars started coming down. And then we all loaded up in our vehicles and went out to deal with all that. And we got ambushed on the way to a bridge where we thought the mortars were being launched from. And, it was just an ambush. And then we drove back into the ambush and started getting RPG'd and shot at again. Lieutenant Armini took an RPG in the stomach. And it was just chaos that day.
Let's listen to Soldier Colby Bazell from the documentary Operation Homecoming.
Sergeant Vance saw me sitting by myself, and he came over and sat next to me. He asked if I was okay. I thought about that one for a second. I told him, I don't know. I told him how I wasn't really in the mood to roll back out for another inning with these guys, and I also told him that I was kind of tripping out about how not everybody that I engaged today had a weapon in their hands. That I wasn't really too sure about what happened to some of those people. Vance started telling me a little bit about his father, who'd been in Vietnam, and who had given him sound advice about situations like this. Put all the things that bother you and keep you awake at night and clog your head up. Put all those things in a shoebox. Put the lid on it and deal with it later. I walked back to my room, thanked God, passed out on my bed. I've put the events of that day in a shoebox, put the lid on it. I haven't opened it since.
Hmm. Is that still the case, Colby? Kept those memories in the shoebox?
I can open it and close it whenever I want to, but yeah, I mean, pretty much, yeah.
Tell us why you started writing.
First, it was just, I was screwing around. I had a blog, and I just thought of, looked at it as a way to, something to do between missions. But then... after a while, I found it to be kind of therapeutic to just sort of sit there and write about what I was experiencing and seeing. And it became a way for me to deal with being over there and to, just a way to deal with it.
In the documentary, it caught my ear when you said you thought writers often have a romantic notion of war. How so?
Sometimes there's a little bit of the hero thing to war memoirs sometimes. I'm talking about war memoirs that are written by somebody who wasn't in the military sometimes. I don't know what I meant by that, but I don't know. Hmm.
Richard Robbins, director and producer and writer of Operation Homecoming. As a journalist and a producer, what did you learn about war and the writing of war as you were making this documentary?
Well, I think the most kind of immediate and striking surprise for me was just how smart and thoughtful and compelling these guys were. I think it's a strange place that we've come to in the culture right now. There's such a separation between the military community and everybody else. And I think in a funny way, that's become sort of convenient both for the military and for everybody else. You know, it keeps us from having to think too much about the hard things that that we are asking these men and women to go through. So, you know, they're just, I think all the stereotypes that seem to have been perpetuated about who serves and why they serve and what they go through turn out not to be very, very accurate.
We've been speaking this hour with Richard Robbins. He's an award-winning documentary filmmaker and is the director, producer, and writer of Operation Homecoming. He joins us from Los Angeles. With us from New York, Colby Bazell, former Army Specialist with the 3rd Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division in Iraq. His short story, Men in Black, is featured in the documentary. And now I'd like to bring in two more guests, both joining us from Seattle, Washington. Captain Ed Rivnak, he's had nearly 20 years in the military and is a flight nurse in the Air Force Reserve. He was in and out of Iraq from February to August 2003 and served in Somalia, Rwanda, and Bosnia. He's the author of the story Medevac Missions, which is featured in Operation Homecoming, and is working on a book of his experiences in the war. Captain Rivnak, nice to have you with us. Thank you for being with us.
Hello, Jane. Thank you.
Also, Jack Lewis is here. He's been serving in the military on and off over the past 20 years. He was team sergeant to tactical FISOP team 1291, deployed in Fort Bragg, North Carolina in 2004. And he served in Iraq from September 04 to July 05, based in Mosul. He was honorably discharged and is now writing a memoir. His story, Roadwork, is also featured in Operation Homecoming. Jack Lewis, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Jane. It's good to be here.
Let me start with you, Jack. I wrote down as I was watching the documentary where you said, war is a passage. It's a story you feel you have to tell. Can you describe what you meant by that?
I suppose that I meant that it was important for me to put these things down, to leave them for some of the people who are special to me, important to me. If other people get anything out of that, that's quite a bonus, I suppose.
I want to play your clip from this new documentary airing tonight, Operation Homecoming, on PBS. It's a clip from your story I mentioned called Roadwork. Can you explain to us what's going to be happening here?
What happened with that incident is that we were busting down the MSR, pretty good clip, about 50 miles an hour, pitch black night, no moon, and we were running in blackout, and there was a bad loud traffic accident sound. One of our vehicles, one of our strikers, had hit a car hard enough to disable two of the striker wheels and just tore the car in half. And we encountered there a man who had survived the accident in the passenger seat, but which was a miracle. But his son had been driving, and he was obliterated.
This is Jack Lewis, his writing from Operation Homecoming.
I went and sat on the back gate of the Striker. I felt the cold creep into me. The old man sat next to me, perhaps too tired to continue his tirade against cruel fate, careless Americans, war and its accidents. I haven't lost a full-grown son, just a little daughter, a baby, and she wasn't torn from me in a terror of rending steel, stamped out by a sudden monster roaring out of the night. She went so quietly that her passing never woke her mother. I like to think she kissed her on the way out, on her way home. But still, sitting on the steel tail of that monster that killed his son, I think maybe I knew just how one Iraqi man felt. Just kill me now, We sat and looked straight into the lights.
As you listened to that, Jack, and as you watched it in the documentary, what now do you most remember about that man and that moment sitting staring into the lights?
The sense that, as a friend of mine said when I returned, it's unfortunate that sometimes we find our common humanity only at a point of great suffering.
What struck me as
we
I
could do better.
We could do better. What struck me as I listened to you as I was watching the documentary, you said that Iraqi man, he's just like me. He's not any different from me.
Well, I suppose different superficially. I mean, politics are dissimilar, I'm sure. We don't share much common culture, don't share a religion, don't share a language. But, the cliche that people are people all over the world, it's totally true. And his pain, his grief, they're not dissimilar from anything you'd find in Middle America.
Captain Rybnak, I want to turn to you for a moment and ask you first, how was the war that you saw on TV different from the war you experienced firsthand?
And the war on TV is very sterile in comparison. You get a 15-second clip that says three Americans were killed today in Iraq, and maybe a few more words, and then they go on to the next story. And my crew, when we heard that on the TV or the radio, we knew that, well, if there are three Americans killed, there were probably 30 wounded, and there was the rest of the story that you never heard, and that was the story that my crew and squadron had to take care of, which was getting all those casualties out of the Middle East and back to the United States.
I want you to set up one of the story that's exactly that situation. This is something you wrote from the documentary Operation Homecoming called Medevac Missions. Tell us what happened here.
This is actually, it's a combination of different missions brought together in one story. After a while, all the missions kind of blend in together. You fly a mission, and you come back, rest, and go fly another mission, and you kind of lose sense of day and night and day of the week, month. What this story does is it takes you from loading the patients up in the Middle East and caring for them in flight and bringing them all the way back to Germany, and not only the physical stress of taking care of patients in flight, but also the emotional stress of dealing with these broken bodies.
Let's listen.
I asked the soldier to wiggle the toes he has. On one side, his toes move fine. On the other side, there is no movement. What is left on that side is cold and hard to the touch. He looks at me, and our eyes are locked. His eyes say, "Tell me I'm going to be okay. Tell me that I'm going to be fine. Tell me I'm going to be whole again." These are some of the longest seconds of my life because I know he's counting on what I say to him. I bend down below the litter to break eye contact. I act like I'm adjusting some of the medical equipment attached to him. My mind is racing. I've always been honest with my patients. Do I lie or tell him the truth? The seconds move so slowly as I fight my internal battle on what is right.
What did you tell him, Captain Rybnak?
My perspective at that time was this guy was never going to walk normal again. And I could see in his eyes he was really counting on, it was like his future was hanging on what I said next. And although he couldn't hear me because of the noise of the plane, I gave him a thumbs up. I lied. I lied to him. I gave him that positive outlook. And in retrospect, we see the casualties very early, right when they get off the battlefield. And as it turns out, a couple days later, I ran into this guy in a field hospital, and he yelled at me, very excited, very animated. He said, "Captain, come over here." And he pulled a sheet away from his feet, and ever so slightly, his toes were moving just a little bit. So I learned a lesson there that you never really can give up hope. You don't know what the end result's going to be.
You mentioned the emotional stress. How often did situations like that happen? Every day, multiple times a day? And what kind of impact does that have on you in the short term and in the long term?
You know, it seemed like when you were on the plane that you were being watched by a dozen eyes or 100 eyes. You always knew that somebody was looking at you, that the patients, you know, some of them strapped in the litter can't move, and the only thing that they have to go on is the few minutes that you're over top of them, and they can't hear you. You can't really talk to them. The noise is so loud. So your facial expressions and your eye contact is doing all the communicating, and you really felt like you had to put up this front, you know, that this professional front of, hey, you guys are taken care of fine. We've got you. You're going to be safe now. Although inside your mind, it might be a completely different story because you're taking care of so many casualties at one time, and sometimes you feel like you're just barely hanging on, keeping it all together.
Jack Lewis, how has the war changed you?
Good Lord, that's a long answer.
In the documentary, you said it left you flat.
It left me for a considerable amount of time kind of truncated, and I think that continues. It kind of nips off the peaks of your emotion, but it hopefully, you know, that's a survival mechanism. Nips off the deep depressions of it as well. And I think that's something you can hold on to while you're in the box. Some of us have a harder time holding on to it once we return.
Colby Bazell, when you did return from Iraq and when people asked you about what you experienced there, what did you say to them? How did you respond to their questions?
Well, sometimes they don't even ask. Like, you know, I'll bump into somebody and they'll be like, oh, where have you been? What have you been up to? And I'll be like, oh, I joined the Army. I went to Iraq. And then, you know, they'll either say nothing or, well, that's cool, or, you know, why'd you do that? Or, you know. So, after a while, I just stopped telling people that I joined the Army and went over there just so I didn't have to deal with, you know, whatever reaction you'd get from someone when you tell them that you were over there.
So people just didn't get it?
Yeah. It's hard to explain. Like when someone asks you, what's it like? You know, how do I explain that in a soundbite? You know, so I just, dodged the question.
Captain Rybnak, I'm curious, these experiences that have been put into words so eloquently and articulately, it strikes me that no matter how good the writing is, there must be some limit to what you can convey, the horror of it. Did you find that?
Yeah. There are some things in war that are too graphic. And some of the things you see you don't want to write about because you just want to forget it. And two, I doubt that a civilian would want to read it.
Or believe it.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Let me take that thought and turn back to Richard Robbins, the producer and director of Operation Homecoming, to air tonight on PBS. Richard, do you think Americans are ready to hear these stories? Do you think they're anxious to hear them, reluctant to hear them? What's your sense?
I've been taking the film around for a couple of months now. I would say that they're profoundly reluctant to hear them. I think there's a deep resistance to wanting. There's such a frustration with the war on both sides of the political fence that I think adding this extra layer just feels like such a burden to people. But I also find that when people have seen the film, they are incredibly grateful for having had the experience. And I think they realize how insulated and isolated we've been from this human side of what's going on. Mm. And I actually think that we're in a sort of dangerous position right now in terms of the frustration leading to a sense that people want to just put this behind us and pretend it didn't happen. And I think that would be a dangerous thing for us as a country to kind of skip digesting and hearing these stories in a way that helps us understand what it means, what we've been through.
Jack Lewis, do you agree with that point as you talk to people being home, that Americans sort of want to put this behind us and you're living with it? You're still in many ways agonizing over what you experienced there.
Well, I think whether it's right or whether it's wrong politically, that's not my issue to address. I'm not a policy guy. But when we send our children to kill other people's children or perhaps be killed themselves or come back in pieces, we owe them a listen. We need to hear their stories because we own all of that.
Captain Rivnik, do you think most of Americans have forgotten that there's a war going on?
I don't think most of Americans have forgotten. You can't forget it. It's there every day. I think a lot of Americans don't want to think deeply about what the result of war is. They see it, they hear it, but they don't want to get emotionally involved with it.
And so, Richard Robbins, having written and produced and directed this documentary, what did you want Americans to feel and understand after they watched Operation Homecoming?
Well, I think I just want them to be open to these stories. I've come to really believe that the stories matter. They matter for us as a nation and as a culture and as we go forward. And I think in some ways it's yet to be seen, but potentially they matter more than the political conversations we've been having. You know, I think that the lasting impact for us may, in the long run, be more important in terms of the human element. And I think it's a dangerous thing as a democracy for us to, there's a lot of talk about honoring the sacrifice, and it's a dangerous thing for us to become so insulated from what that sacrifice really entails.
I've been joined this hour from Los Angeles by the writer, director, and producer of Operation Homecoming, Richard Robbins. Also joining us is a group of soldiers featured in the documentary. Colby Bazell was an Army specialist with the 3rd Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division in Iraq, and was in the war from November 2003 to October 2004. Captain Ed Rivnak, flight nurse in the Air Force Reserve. He's retiring after nearly 20 years of service this summer. He was in and out of Iraq from February to August 2003. And Jack Lewis served in Iraq from September 2004 to July 2005. Captain Rivnak, I'd like to ask you if you would to read another one of your writings written in July 2003 called Last Mission. Would you read that for us?
Sure. The patient that required the most physical attention was a young soldier from the 101st Airborne Division. He was involved in the raid that killed Saddam Hussein's sons. He had a gunshot wound to the chest, 2 chest tubes, and was coughing up blood. Coughing up blood is not like what you see in the old war movies. It's not a slight single cough, followed by a little trickle of bright red ketchupy-looking stuff. In the movies, the little trickle of ketchup is always neatly placed at the corner of the mouth. Real blood is dark, bluish red, and it doesn't trickle. It congeals in the lungs and is painfully coughed up, like a piece of bubble gum that's gone down the wrong pipe. Oftentimes, the patient has to cough violently to expel the glob. I tried to keep the soldier sedated until we landed, though I wasn't completely successful. At times during the flight, we talked about his combat. He said, "I thought we had him. I was walking back to my Humvee, fairly certain the battle was over. I was casually standing there when someone from another building shot me in the back." This statement was significant to me. I had caught the European news just before the mission. The commentator was angry that overwhelming force was used to kill Saddam's sons. He wanted to know why the U.S. could not wait to negotiate a surrender. Typical of the media, they only had a small piece of what actually happened.
That last line makes me want to ask you and follow up. Generally speaking, then, has the media gotten it right or gotten it wrong in Iraq during this war?
The media only has a certain amount of time, you know, to broadcast what's going on, so they can only pick little snippets. You know, I think the movie and the book Operation Homecoming has got it right because it's actually showing you the experience of war. But the media in general is still only scratching the surface.
I want to turn to the phones for a minute. A lot of people calling, wanting to join our conversation. Peter is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Peter, hello. You're on the line.
Yes, hi. A great topic. First, I'm a combat, Marine combat veteran of 1st Marine Division Vietnam, and I think the first, it's great to have these guys writing their experiences, guys and ladies. First thing is they are there. It's the real deal. And no matter how great an author you are, if you haven't done it, the combat writings from people who have been there and experienced are just totally different because it's the real thing. As simple as, you've been in combat, a lot of close in combat, I mean, you don't hear it, the smell of blood. I mean, you're in close quarters fighting with people, blood's everywhere, and you never forget that. That and gunpowder and the screams. But, I mean, writers who have never experienced it just don't have it. The important thing I also think, too, is if for a topic of conversation along these lines is not only for this war, it's the next 25, 50 years, is the huge disconnect between the kids that are warriors and fighting for our country and the middle class and upper class kids, with few exceptions. Nobody's in the military. And I think it's important to get for that to also be addressed, regardless of how this Iraq situation is going to hopefully turn out expeditiously. But that's... I wonder what your authors think about that.
Peter,
that's a big social issue.
Thank you for your call, Peter. I appreciate it. Colby Bazell, let me turn that question to you. Is there a disconnect? Do you see it? Did you experience it in Iraq?
I experience it now, kind of. It feels like the only people that are called to sacrifice and participate in this war seems to be either the family members or the people actively in the military or the people out of the military. You know, they have to worry about getting called back up and redeployed over there. You could live in America and not even have the war affect you, like just go through everyday normal life without having to even think about it if you choose not to. There's a lot of people that don't even know that we have troops in Afghanistan right now.
Jack Lewis, what do you say to Americans, many of whom have given nothing for this war? We go to work, we take the kids to school, go to the grocery store, mow the lawn, but haven't sacrificed or really offered anything. What do you say to them?
Well, I think we've all sacrificed something, whether we know it or whether we don't. It's certainly in our interest to become aware of what those sacrifices are. If your neighbors go to war, and a lot of your neighbors have, we've sent 1.5 million people there, and they've come from all kinds of social strata. That affects your community. They're part of your community. It changes the tone. It changes the flavor. And I think we need to know in what ways that affects us all.
John is calling from Panama City, Florida. John, hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
First, I'd like to thank these veterans for their sacrifices. I'm an American who thinks about the war every day, and I'm emotionally involved. And I would like to thank the Vietnam veterans as well. But I know Richard said he didn't want to discuss politics, so maybe he can answer my question without doing that, and any of the other veterans as well. But there are debates here about the merits of the war all the time, every day. And those opposed to the war, especially who never served, are often accused of not supporting the troops. And I'd like to know how, as real veterans, these gentlemen feel about that accusation that those against the war are letting down the troops. That's my question.
John, thank you. Captain Rybnak, do you want to answer that?
Oh, sure. Give me the hard question. I don't think the people opposed to the war or vocal against the war are letting down the troops. I actually see it as them supporting the troops, because that's why the U.S. military is there, is to protect our freedom and our rights. And when I see someone out there protesting and speaking their honest, open opinion, that tells me I've done my job as a serviceman protecting that right. I have been to many countries, provinces, in my 20-year career that those rights don't exist.
Richard Robbins, let me ask you in terms of the politics. When it came to the riding, was there ever an issue of separating the politics of the war from the act of fighting the war?
I think it was a fear when we started, because we knew we wanted to make a film that wasn't about the politics. It turns out that the good writing isn't about politics. And I think for most of the people who've served, you know, they just, none of them, you know, if they have to sit down and write about the profound experiences that they've been through, have any interest in writing about politics. And that's not to say that they're not interested in the political issues. A lot of them are, and I certainly am. But I think that the experiences that people go through can enrich your understanding and inform your opinion, no matter what side of this debate you're on.
Rita,
in some ways, actually, yeah. I've come to think that having strong political opinions is a barrier to being open to hearing about the human side. You know, people feel so passionately about their political opinions that they seem to have let themselves off the hook from thinking about what it really means on a human level.
Hmm. Let's get to another call from East Chatham, Massachusetts. Rita is on the line. Hi, Rita. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Jane. Thank you.
Thank you.
One of your guests spoke of mentioning to people that he sees that he's been to Iraq, and they sometimes avoid any further conversation. And I've often thanked veterans for being there and for sacrificing, and I wonder if that's the right thing to do. Sometimes it sounds so hollow, like I say thank you for being there and thank you for protecting us. And I also just want to let them know that our family is very aware of what's going on, and I have brought my children to anti-war rallies, we are against the war, yet we do support the troops. Thank you.
Rita, thank you. I have had similar circumstances in an airport last week, walked up to a serviceman to say thank you and feel oddly uncomfortable doing that as much as I mean it. What is the right response? Maybe each of you can quickly respond. Colby, you first.
I don't know how to answer that. I mean, I get asked, not anymore because I'm out of the military, but like, you know, when I was in the military at airports and stuff like that, you know, you always got the stranger thanking you. But since I've been out, I don't really get thanked all that much, you know, for it. You know, I have to have some item of clothing or a haircut or something to make me look like I was in the military, but I don't know. I don't know what the right answer is.
Jack Lewis, what do you think is the right answer? What should people say?
Oh, I'm a big fan of the hug.
That simple, huh?
I say go to the hug every time.
Captain Rivnak, what about you?
I've never felt that that's a hollow expression, and I've always been very grateful when someone says thank you for your service. Another side of it is, though I feel a little guilty when I hear it because it always makes me think of the casualties I took care of or the guys who didn't make it who never get to hear that thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you as a soldier, what goes through your mind as you roll out every morning on patrol in Afghanistan, in Iraq? What are you thinking? Colby?
I usually think, well, how long is this mission going to take? Hopefully we get back in time so we can go to chow. At first, you know, you get that. In the back of your head, you're thinking, you know, is today going to be the day? Today going to be the day I don't make it back or lose one of my limbs? But over time, that voice kind of goes away and you just look at it as a job, you know, rolling out and back. But it's always in the back of your mind, that thought.
Were you afraid often, Captain Rivnak?
Afraid, absolutely.
Every day,
every
moment.
After you keep seeing people, guys that look like you that are wearing the same uniform as you, day after day after day. After a while, you just start thinking, "Gosh, it's only a matter of time before they get to me." So yeah, I was afraid.
Jack Lewis, would you read to us one of your pieces?
Be happy to.
Thank you.
This is a short blurb about Election Day in January of 2005. You always kind of look for meaning in what you're doing, and there's, frankly, there's just not a whole lot of meaning at the ground level in war. And this, I found a little meaning, and I tried to hold on to that. And what had happened, I had been shut down on my PSYOP mission by our supported commander, and I was looking around for a way to help out. Since I now had officially nothing left to do, I rejoined my adopted infantry squad, and we patrolled the nearby streets on foot, looking for shooters who were targeting voters. I took along my digital camera. We waved and smiled at the voters, then crossed the MSR over to where we'd been receiving fire from. I put my camera away and brought my rifle to low ready. Staff Sergeant Big Sal Salinas led the squad. Just a strap hanger, I tagged along and pulled rear security for them. We got nothing. Found some AK brass at an intersection, tactically questioned a couple of guys, and neutralized no one. We did figure out that the gunfire was coming down the alley on an angle, and that Charger's 240 gunners on the roof were shooting at hallucinations. But that wasn't a huge surprise. They were just having a good time up there, rocking the gun. Every time a round or two came down, they'd burn through a belt and a half in response. We spent a lot of your money that day. Our little patrol stopped the constant AK fire, though. The rest of the city was a hodgepodge of scattered gunfire and the occasional big, black, smoky boom. But the consistent fire from across the way was stopped. After that, it was just sporadic hit-and-run stuff. One striker gunner had the charging handle of his 50 cal shot off in front of his face, but he was lucky. No Purple Heart for him that day. I-Pro rules. And the voters rolled in. They came from all over the city. They came with their children and donkeys and wives. I look at the pictures now and can hardly believe the lines. Hundreds of Iraqis holding up their proud purple fingers. Women bandaged head to foot in their burqas, voting for the first time in their lives. Venerable old men voting in maybe their second real election. Young hip guys in sharp western suits. Farmers in grubby dishdashes. Donkey carts and favorite dogs. My favorite shot is of an old man, his young son, and his old wife, all giving me the finger in lurid living purple. The ink, semi-permanent, prevented them from voting twice. It made them targets for insurgents. And it made them proud. It was a sight to see.
Was that your proudest moment in Iraq, Jack Lewis?
No, that was my second proudest moment in Iraq.
What was your first?
When my driver was injured, was wounded on mission, and his first thought was to continue his mission, make sure the people around him were okay. And when he showed back up on the FOB and they dropped ramp, and I saw him with his hand all bandaged up, big as his head, first thing he said to me was, "I'm okay, Sergeant."
Richard Robbins, final word for you. You're the director and producer of this documentary, Operation Homecoming, tonight to air on PBS. What were you left with on a personal level after reading the writings of these men and interviewing them?
Well, I guess I would just try and say, partly based on the clips that we've heard and these very thoughtful voices here, that ultimately the experience for me has been pretty uplifting, because I've found the human resilience and thoughtfulness and kind of deep engagement from these troops to be really inspiring in the face of so much frustration on the political front. The people who serve really are something that we should all be proud of, you know, no matter how we feel about this war.
Richard Robbins, the documentary is Operation Homecoming, Riding the Wartime Experience, to air tonight on PBS. Thank you for your work.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
And Colby Bazell, Captain Ed Rivnak, and Jack Lewis, we thank you for your service to our country and for your writings today.
Thank you, Jane.
Thanks, Jane. Appreciate it.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation online at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.